Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Question for you. How did you learn to read? Do you remember? Do you remember the process? Do you remember when you were a kid, how you were taught to read? Probably, if you're like most of us of the age who would be listening, someone told you that the letter A makes an ah sound, or A in certain sources, but ah, you know, or F makes a f, and so on. And you would have, it was phonetic, and it was a systematic approach of teaching this equals this, therefore apply this to this, and right? That's how most of us learned, and it worked. Well, that's not always done these days. And I did not know anything about this. I don't have kids in elementary school right now, so this was all new to me. Modern educational theory says the three cueing method is superior. And what is the three cueing method? Well, we're going to get into that in a little second for you to understand. But in fact, let me bring in my guest. And rather than me even try to pretend to understand what this is, let me bring in Dr. Erin Panda. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Child and Youth Studies at Brock University. She's also a cognitive neuroscientist who studies the link between learning to read and changes in the brain. Dr. Erin Panda joins us now. Thank you for doing this today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on.
When I heard about the three cueing method, this is a phrase that I have honestly, again, because I don't have kids in elementary school now, we're way past that. I had never heard about this. What is this?
Well, actually, I think the way that you phrased it, take a step backwards, and your question about how did you learn to read is a really good way to think about all of this. There's a big debate in education for the last 100 years or so about whether it should be taught in the way that it sounds like you learned, you know, hearing the sounds of language, or if it should be taught in a more whole language approach. So that was done for a lot of people who went to school in like the 80s and 90s. That was more like memorize the word. And don't worry about the spelling. You'll get that. It's more important just to be exposed to lots of books and to promote a love of reading, which is really important. And then what happened was a balanced approach, which basically said, okay, we'll take a little bit of both and we'll leave it to the teacher to decide. And the three cueing method was what was and still is right now in the Ontario curriculum. And it's actually not what you'd learned at all. It's more, and actually science shows that it's not effective, even though that's the way a lot of kids are being taught to read. It's more about looking at the picture in the book, looking at the first letter of the word, and trying to guess what the word says. So right now in a lot of classes in Ontario, the kids are not being explicitly taught what the sounds of language are, strategies for sounding out words. They're not learning those skills at all.
But okay, so and again, like I don't pretend to be an educational expert, thank goodness, because I would think that the way we had learned it was fine. But this seems like kind of hit and miss. That there are going to be some kids that can get it, and there are other kids that probably won't. It seems far less. What's the word? Far less structured, or as I said before, systematic. It seems just more out there.
Yeah, it's kind of haphazard. And actually, you're right. Like
that's a good word.
Most kids will learn to read whatever you give them. They'll figure it out. But for some kids, about 10, so conservative estimates put dyslexia or reading disability at 10%. So if you think about a typical class with 30 kids, that means three kids are not just going to be able to pick it up on their own. And if they're not given explicit and systematic instruction, they're never going to pick it up on their own. They might get, if their parents can afford to take them to a psychologist, they might have an assessment done and get a diagnosis of dyslexia. But that costs families about $5,000. And they're given then accommodations in school, but they're not taught then how to read. And that's really tragic because we know that if they're given explicit instruction, almost all kids can learn to read.
But who is this newer idea? Again, it's not really all that new by the sounds of it, but who is this newer idea then supposed to benefit? If you've got kids with dyslexia and other reading disabilities, is this supposed to help them because now we're not so caught up on the order of the letters and you can guess the word? Or is it, I'm not sure who this is supposed to be benefiting.
So the approach that's being advocated right now is to go back to the phonics instruction and to do it in an explicit and systematic way. and it's not going to hurt anybody, and it's really going to help those 10% of kids that need to have things explicitly, need to have this explicitly taught to them. You can kind of think of this, it's called universal design for learning. You know, like in whenever you're in a public space and they have those buttons beside the door that if you push it, the door opens. So that's
right.
Really going to help somebody who has restrictions to their mobilities. It's going to also help people who maybe have their hands full or who don't want to touch the door or who maybe are pushing a stroller. And it's definitely not going to hurt the people who could also open the door. So by taking this more systematic approach to teaching literacy, explicitly teaching the sounds of language, explicitly teaching, you know, the parts of words, it's not going to hurt anybody, especially if, I mean, teachers, I have great respect for teachers of I think they play such an important role. And
sure.
So what's being advocated here is just having more support for them.
Right. And look, I'm not blaming teachers for this one. This is not their idea to do this. They're teaching what they're being told to teach.
That's right.
And what you're talking about, where we're now going to go back to phonics, is because of there's this report that came out, the Right to Read report, which is suggesting we start to look back at the original ideas more, because if I got my numbers right here, it's about a quarter of people in EQAO are not at the provincial standards in reading, which is outrageous.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I think everybody's projecting that those numbers are going to be even lower now after the pandemic and the gaps in education. So those were from before the pandemic.
Okay, so you're a cognitive neuroscientist, and I was trying to think today of an example of like how I could put this. If you were teaching a course in neuroscience and we were studying the brain, you would not simply take an anatomical brain, a cadaver's brain, and point at it and say, figure it out. You would give me implicit instruction of where the parts of the brain are and what's there. Like you would never say, okay, the cerebellum and the cerebral cortex and all, they're all in there. Just figure it out. You would never do that because it doesn't make any sense. That's what it sounds like this approach to reading kind of is.
Yeah, the approach that has been in our schools now for a while has been sort of more of an inquiry-based approach to reading. If you give kids access to books and literature, that they'll pick it up on their own. And like I said, a lot of kids will, but not all.
How do we... Okay, so with it right now, and I love that we're now looking back to a system that clearly worked. And I always say this, I say this with math as well, that I always find it so interesting that we all want to do, or certain people want to do this new math, and yet they're presumably smart people making these decisions, and they came up and learned the old way, and it was good enough for them to get to be as smart as they are, and now they say, oh, but it's not really that good. I always find that odd, and same with reading. But how do we know with this older system, that the one we're in right now, the three Qs, how do we know if it's not working until we're almost too late and the child is now way behind?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the problem. We have a system right now, we call it the wait-to-fail method. And so we, you know, assume that kids will pick it up on their own. If they have troubles, we say, okay, well, let's wait and see if they can catch up. And we wait and wait and wait, and we wait until they're in grade four, and all of a sudden now their demands have shifted, so we're not teaching them to read anymore. We're expecting them to, you know, learn about science from reading, and that's often when kids get identified. And it's really tragic, because if instead we take an approach where right at the beginning in kindergarten, we have still through play, I think we've learned a lot since back in the 50s. We know that kids learn really well when they're playing and they're actively involved in their own learning. But give them the tools to play with and check their reading, screen it regularly in kindergarten. Teach teachers what they need to do so that they can identify which kids maybe need to work on which areas, and do that right from the beginning so that you can prevent a lifelong disability.
There is a piece that Dr. Pander wrote. It's in the Spec. The headline is Right to Read Report Offers a Great Opportunity. It's on thespec.com right now. As an advancer to what we've just been talking about, I would encourage people to go look it up and give it a read. It's what prompted this conversation. It's an excellent piece. Dr. Aaron Pander from Brock University, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And anybody who's interested in learning more, the Ontario branch of the International Dyslexia Association, they've got a really great website with lots of really great resources for parents and for teachers.
Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
So that song was Taking Care of Business. What if we made it plural? Taking Care of Businesses. That could be, you know, if Krista Boyer was really on her game, she would have had BTO remake that song just for what she's doing right now. It's called Hamilton Business Rally. Krista Boyer joins us now. Krista, how are you?
Oh, Scott, are you there?
I am here. Krista, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Sorry, you cut out there for a minute. And yes, you know, you stole my lead up, because when I heard that song, I'm like, how perfect is that?
Yeah, well, you know, Ben tries to do that. Ben tries to be clever with the music, and he usually is. He finds something appropriate. But tell me about the Hamilton Business Rally. That's what you've put together here. That's what this is called. For those who know nothing about what this is, explain.
Yes, so the Hamilton Business Rally is a month-long event. It's taking place in the month of June. Throughout the month of June, what we're doing is we're releasing a series of 12 acts, which are intended to support our local businesses. And then we're asking people to participate by completing each act. And then once they complete an act, they are entered, and completion of that act includes self-reporting it through Instagram. And once we see that self-report, they're entered into a draw. We're having weekly and monthly draws where the giveaways are $25, $50, and $100 gift prizes. And those gift prizes are gift cards where we have our participating businesses, and they get to choose from that list where they want to get that gift card from. So essentially, it's a support local initiative.
Okay. And when you say you have to perform an act, that's a little intimidating. It's a little daunting. What do you mean by you have to perform an act?
Yes. So some of our acts have been released already, and they include such things as shop local for a gift, shop for essential.
Okay.
Right? Yes.
So it's not like do four somersaults down Concession Street.
What's that?
It's not like do four somersaults down Concession Street.
Well, we might throw a few of those fun ones in there just to see who's going to do it.
Yeah, okay. No, you had me concerned with the, you have to do an act. I think, okay, people may be a little daunted by this, but okay. So yeah, doing something like shopping for essentials or buy a gift, that's something that makes way more sense than my idea, which is why you're doing this and not me. Thank goodness. So where did the idea come from? Why are you doing this?
So it was actually, it originated at the start of COVID when we were first hit with that first shutdown, you know, and we're all standing around, you know, asking ourselves what's happening in the world and what can we do to participate. That's when the idea of the Hamilton Business Rally was born. It was part of a larger initiative that myself and a group of volunteers had put together. That one didn't kick off. It was too much at the time. So I took the Hamilton Business Rally out of it. I matured it and got it ready for June. And here we are 2 years later.
I mean, your job, for those who don't know you, they may have seen your face around or your signs around because you're a commercial realtor. What would be the connection between a commercial realtor and this that would support local businesses?
Yeah, so I almost exclusively deal with small businesses in my business. I'm very focused on retail leasing in the city of Hamilton, which puts me right in front of the businesses, puts me in a place where I'm dealing with them directly and helping them secure their locations. And at the same time, as I'm building those relationships, I'm seeing the struggles that they have, even aside from COVID. So local businesses, even prior to real estate, have always been near and dear to my heart. I consider myself a localvore. I only shop local for the most part. And I see great, you know, I get great enjoyment out of doing that, just because, again, there's relationships that can be built when you're visiting your local businesses.
You called yourself a what?
A localvore.
Like a carnivore or an omnivore, you're a localvore.
Yeah. All right. I said that years ago. I'm like, I like that. That's how I'll identify myself.
That's a good one. You now, see, you just introduced that to a whole new group of people who had never heard that before. So you got to get T-shirts made with that one. There's a way to do it as well. Yeah. So it's you've seen, as you're dealing with these businesses, that they have, in fact, been hit as hard as we've heard through this?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, and it's been a mix. I've seen some businesses do very well. You know, I helped some businesses get second locations throughout COVID. But then on the other side of the coin, I saw businesses struggle stories of businesses having to shut their doors because they couldn't move forward. COVID did too much of a number on them, and it's so important to give back to our local businesses. They do so much for us as far as providing, you know, variety, quality, you know, unique experiences in the city. So this is really why I'm hoping people will participate in the Hamilton Business Rally so we can rally around our local businesses.
There is a tough balance, though, with this for some people. We want to support local businesses, and yet, you know, for a lot of people, money is tight, and to buy something from a big box store or a brand name place or whatever else, a big chain, it can be cheaper. How do you balance that when, you know, you get better service perhaps, and you support people locally better if you buy local, but it could cost a little more?
Yes. Yeah. You know, that for sure is a challenge. I would suggest to people that look to see if that's actually the case as far as cost, because I've experienced that myself where I've looked at big box stores being the solution for the item I'm looking for, only to learn that a local business actually has a better price. It was my assumption that led me to the big box store. Aside from that, you know, if it's a cost thing, there's other ways we could support local businesses, referring them out, give them good reviews online, you know, supporting them through social media. There's other ways where we can still participate in their success.
So the Hamilton Business Rally, who is involved in this? Is it every single local store? Does that, like, would anybody count if you wanted to? One of the acts, I'm on the website right now, and one of the acts that we're talking about was like, comment, or share a promotion from a local business. Could that be any local business or only the ones that have connected with this?
No, any local business. So it's open to everyone, whether or not you have a brick and mortar store, or if you're an e-commerce store, if you're out of your house. You're welcome. If you are a local business here in Hamilton, we want to partner with you. If you don't partner with us, you can still participate to a degree. Where you don't get to participate is when we have our winners. They're going to be given a list of local businesses who have signed up, and it's from that list that they get to choose where they want to spend their money for that gift card. For businesses that haven't signed up, it's free to do so. There's no cost to them. We'll send them a marketing package, and they can use it at their will.
Is this something that, well, let me stop for a second. Like, there, a few years ago, and it stopped, of course, because of COVID, like so many other things, but there was a thing that we used to love on the show in November for burger places, Novemberger, which was, and it grew and grew and grew. Is this something that you could see growing into an annual thing, or is this a one-off just to help people get back on their feet?
No, it's definitely designed to have legs, and we're seeing that as we're rolling it out this month, that we can grow it, perfect it, so that next year we have something a bit grander for the event. So I do see this being an annual event. I'd love for that to be the case.
Is it harder to get people, shoppers, aware of this, or is it harder to get the businesses aware of this?
Oh, the businesses have been great. We have all the BIAs have partnered: Chamber of Commerce, Stony Creek Chamber, Black Owned Hamilton, Shop Hamont, Hamilton Hive. Like, we have so many fempreneurs. We have so many businesses who have partnered with us, and aside from those groups, independents like the Other Bird restaurants and Hamburger, the businesses are on board, you know, because they recognize this is a great initiative. Yes, they want to be involved. Anyone that's supporting local, absolutely, let's get involved. The uptake that we've been having challenges with is getting the shoppers involved, getting them out there. And the interesting thing is most of these acts we're committing already. So the one next step that people need to do to participate is just take a photo of it, share it with us on our Instagram, and now you're part of something bigger.
Yeah, and the acts, as I say, the acts, by the looks of it, now that I know what that means, don't look all that onerous, as you say. Really, streaking Fennel Street is not one of the things you're going to have to do to win this thing. Not this year, anyway.
Yeah, we have a surprise act coming up later in the month, so I wouldn't take that off.
I'm betting it's not that. Yeah, I'm betting it's not that. The website is hamiltonbusinessrally.com. There is all kinds of stuff there. Krista Boyer is the person who is behind this. Krista, really appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this today.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you having me.
Once again, Hamilton Business Rally, RALLY, hamiltonbusinessrally.com. Go take a look. And you know what? As Krista says, you're probably out there doing some of this stuff anyway. You're probably shopping at some of these stores anyway. Well, why not be part of this? And you know, I mean, even if you're already buying stuff, it's probably going to be really helpful for them to know that this works so they can do it again in future years and try and grow this thing, because we do want to help local businesses. We do. I mean, and that's not to say never shop at Amazon or never shop at Costco or anything, but you know, local businesses are there too. Use them as well.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let's bring in the big boss man himself. Not Elvis. Bubba O'Neill from CHCH TV. We had to leave that dramatic pause there. Sir, how are you tonight?
Oh, doing well. You know, yeah. kind of a soft night in the world of sports. So I think we deserve this every once in a while.
And they do call you Big Boss Man around the station, right? That is the name. That's how they refer to you at all times, or sir.
No, only you do.
Oh, so I would have thought sir or your eminence, something along those lines. Any of those things would work. I got a stat for you that I want to run by you that I came across the other day, and I'm not quite sure I have the explanation for this. I may have part of an explanation or a theory. Until Gary Bettman became commissioner of the NHL, there had never been, now there were only one third of the teams, go back to original six, there was only two out of the six teams were Canadian. I could advance it to 16 teams. It was still the minority. But until Gary Bettman became commissioner, there was never more than six straight years without a Canadian team winning a Stanley Cup. It's now been 29 years under Gary Bettman's leadership that there has not been a Canadian team that's won a Stanley Cup. And I'm not suggesting for a second that they're rigging it or they're doing something to prevent them, but something weird is happening, Bubba, that a Canadian team just can't seem to win. Why?
I can't even believe that you are equating the two. And I know that Gary Bettman is not the most popular man in this country, but he has nothing to do with this. And this, there's no fix. There's no,
like, well, I'm not saying there's a fix. I'm not saying there's a fix at all.
You're putting the two together somewhat. You've drawn a comparison that since Gary Bettman's leadership, no Canadian team has won a cup. So I can't help but think that. I mean, are you blaming Gary Bettman for the inadequacies over the last 50 years for, I mean, certainly not 50 years for his time, of the Toronto Maple Leafs? Like,
no.
the inadequacies?
That's on them.
The Ottawa Senators have had a little touch. They went to a cup final. They were an overtime goal from Sidney Crosby away from going one. Not that all long ago before they hit the tank and they're not that good. Montreal had a taste last year, and that, let's be honest, that was like the most flukiest thing we've ever seen.
Yes.
In a setup of a season that really, you know, some would say probably deserves an asterisk. If there's any team, Edmonton have been a joke. I mean, how many first rounders did they have in the first overall?
I think four.
First overall picks did they have in a span over a decade? Like, I mean, and they too actually went to a final and lost to Carolina. I think Vancouver is probably the best example. I mean, they went to, I think gone twice in under his leadership and went to game seven twice and blew it. Like, I don't know. Like,
I'm not saying there's any kind of fix or anything along those lines. It could be simply the business model that has been brought in under the Gary Bettman regime
that changes the thing.
Salary cap for part of it, sure, yeah. Yep. But
that's something that all the Board of Governors agreed to. So you can't just blame him.
And I say, I'm not blaming Gary Bettman. It's the timing of it that if you look at his time. He awarded the Stanley Cup to the Montreal Canadiens he had been commissioner for a couple months when the Canadiens won in 93. And since then, there has not been a Canadian team. He's not awarded a cup to one Canadian team. Something has changed within the league, because I think it's too fluky to say all of a sudden all the teams got stupid. All of a sudden all the teams got unlucky. All of a sudden all the teams got bad for years. Some of them have. I mean, look, you're right. The Leafs are the Leafs. It's not Gary Bettman's fault that for so many years the Leafs have been awful. Same with Edmonton. But I look at this and I go, it's just a weird thing that something changed when he became commissioner, or around the time he became commissioner.
Well, all I can say is win. Like, I mean, just win. Like, I mean, because, like I said, Vancouver has gone twice under his leadership. two game sevens, they lose. And really, the one against Boston, they probably should have won. The one against New York, I think New York were the better team. Calgary went there. Calgary went there once, and they lost to Tampa Bay. And, you know, very much to a team that, you know, with Dave Andrechuk, and I guess the beginning of really what was, the building of a solid franchise there. Edmonton went once, and that run, if you're really honest with yourself, they backed in on the second to last day and got into the postseason, and then went on the wildest run and lost to Carolina, who were really a better team. Montreal, they're certainly not the franchise they've been. You know, they don't have the advantages of getting, you know, the top players in Quebec anymore. The Leafs have caused their own problems. Ottawa, you know, as I said, had a taste, and I don't know what. I just feel like that you got to win. Like, this is your own.
Yeah, and even if we say it's the salary cap has been brought in, which is 100% mm-hmm. true under Gary Bettman, even if you say, okay, so the Canadian teams have lost the advantage they had once upon a time as the big money teams, or that even go back further where, like, the Montreal Canadiens had all the Quebec players that they could take before the draft. Even if somewhere along the way, though, surely in 29 years, a Canadian team would have overcome the salary cap problem or overcome whatever. It's such a weird number. And once again, I you're correct. When I mentioned Gary Bettman's name, it probably does sound like I'm saying it's his fault. I'm not saying it's his fault. I'm not. It's just a weird alignment of timing that for that length of time that Gary Bettman has never presented a cup to, and he won't this year because Edmonton is now out. It's very weird.
It's definitely unfortunate because I think this is, as we know, the home of hockey. But unfortunately, as I said, I think these teams have nothing to blame but themselves in many cases. And I can't even think of too many times, even under this leadership that you're talking about, that a Canadian team has won a President's Trophy. Even right? Am I wrong here?
Has there been one? I don't know.
I don't think there's been a Canadian team to win the President's Trophy in that time space, that time span either. So I don't know. I don't know how you change that. As I said, I think Edmonton really, but the amount of first round draft picks that they've been able to acquire over the years, and let me throw this to you too. The way it is now. And we love our country, right? Like, I'm not knocking our country here, but what team of the Canadian teams is a destination place to play where you want to play?
I would say
the Leafs when you're old and done.
Well, I think the Leafs are a destination team just because they are so well known. I mean, look, let's go the other way. How many teams in Canada are an absolute, if you're an American, you're really not interested in playing for them kind of team? I would say that would be Winnipeg for sure. I would say Ottawa probably for sure. I would say Edmonton maybe, although I think most guys would want to play with Connor McDavid.
No one wants to go to Edmonton. Chris Pronger.
Yeah, I think Chris Pronger's wife, wasn't it his wife who said we got to get out of here? But he's listening. So there's an issue there. There is an issue for sure. By the way, 2003 Ottawa won the President's Trophy, and 11 and 12 Vancouver won it. So there's been three. Okay, so we got there's been three.
Okay, so Ottawa and Vancouver, and both of them ended up going to the Cup, I would guess. Actually, no, that year the Ottawa won. I think Buffalo knocked them out. Did they not?
I think Buffalo. Anyway, just a very weird, one. I am not all things considered, I am not among the Gary Bettman haters. I certainly think if you live in this city, you probably have a bone to pick with Gary Bettman for the way that some of the choices were made and that there probably should be a team here rather than Ottawa. But, you know, I'm not a Gary Bettman hater. I think you can look at what he's done in the NHL and say the business has grown exponentially and there are good things. I think the Arizona thing is a farce.
So he's done his job then.
I would say, look, if you're an owner of one of the other teams, I think you would look at this and you would say Gary Bettman has done his job for you. Absolutely he has. And the league is much bigger. There's much more money. There's much more footprint. There's a lot of things that you would look at and say, Gary Bettman has done his job well. As I said a moment ago, Arizona is a farce. And I don't know why he's got his horse tied so strongly to this cart, but he does. And there are a few other things, but I don't think there's a commissioner out there that you're going to point to and say they've never done anything wrong. So I'm not a Gary Bettman hater. It's just a weird thing.
I don't think you're a Gary Bettman fan.
I'm kind of an agnostic, if tilting towards not a fan only because of the Hamilton thing. But when everybody gets all fired up about hating Gary Bettman and booing him on the stage and everything else, I don't think it's warranted. And if someone says that Gary Bettman is the guy who has saved hockey and is the greatest thing to ever happen to hockey, I would not go for that either. I'm kind of in the middle. It's like, you know, he's done a fine job, and you know, so there you go. All right, let us move to another team in this country that has gone a long time without a championship. Speaking of championship droughts, this Saturday, the Hamilton Tiger Cats kick off a new season, still searching for that elusive Grey Cup that has not been able to find a way to Hamilton since 1999. Bubba, okay. Oh. When we said the odds of 29 years of an NHL team, of a Canadian NHL team not getting the cup in all that time, that those odds are long. You've got 8, sometimes 9 teams in a CFL, and it's been since 1999. The odds are impossible that Hamilton would not have won at some point along the way. The odds are impossible, and yet they haven't. Is this the year they finally do it?
Well, let's be honest. Without hosting the Grey Cup this year, I think there's a little bit of pressure that's been relieved. I think there was a lot of pressure on them last year to get to that big game, and as there will be for the Saskatchewan Roughriders this year to, you know, be there and represent the West and host a Grey Cup game. I think that's just naturally instilled, especially when you're a good team. You know, as I was saying to another colleague today, I believe the Tiger Cats are probably going to be the class of the East. But what I think we're going to see is that I think the East is narrowing. I think it's getting better. I think the Argos, even though, you know, people forget too, the Argonauts won the division last year. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton beat them in the East Final. So Toronto are getting closer. Ottawa are all of a sudden Hamilton light, and you believe with the general manager there, they're not going to have the season that they had last year, which was absolutely horrendous. Only the Elks played worse, and Montreal are on the brink of doing something as well too. They can beat anyone in this league, so I think that the East is, you know, going to be really threatened, the Tiger Cats are going to be threatened for their crown this year. I think that they've lost some players, but they've also added some players. I'm curious to see what's going to happen at the quarterback position. And not so much that I don't believe in Dane Evans, but we've seen it time and time again where in this league, it's hard to start 18 straight games, really difficult. And for a guy that likes to scramble around in the pocket a little bit and move, and that's one of his strengths, I wonder if he's going to be able to take hits for 18 games and be healthy. So if as opposed to what we saw last year where Masoli had Evans and Evans had Masoli, and I guess there was 2 games with David Watford that the Ticats did go 2-0, I wonder if this Ticat team can survive the loss of Dane Evans and what happens at that case if they do.
You have just given nightmares to every Ticat fan because that's absolutely the question is what the heck happens if the quarterback goes down, and for the reasons you just said that we don't have in this city now on this franchise the depth. Well, we don't know. We don't think we do. We may, but we don't think we have the depth of quarterback that has been there for the past couple of years. Now that said, Bubba, one of the things that we've learned over the years in the CFL is many of the greatest quarterbacks that have come out into this league in the last 20 years were guys that no one had really heard of. And then all of a sudden, the 2 guys in front of them went down and the third stringer came in and you went, wow, that guy's great. So right. maybe they have that guy as their second or third stringer now. We don't know. But I don't think you really want to be testing that if you're the Ticats, because Dane Evans has shown he can win in this league. nobody else really has shown with great conviction that they can win consistently. Who's on this team?
None of them have taken a regular season. Any of the backups and the guy in the practice roster have taken a regular season snap in the Canadian Football League. And that's a concern. I have to say that. I think we saw Evans and we saw enough of Evans to know that he could play. Even Masoli, when Masoli was sort of the guy in limbo and Zach Collaros was here, we knew that Masoli could play. He played in an Eastern final before, Zach took back the job and after coming back from injury. So, yeah, this is the great unknown here. And as I said, I think this team is very good across the board. Linebacker, defensive back, running back, I think is solid. The wide receivers are emerging. But that is a concern of that quarterback situation over a long, long season. And
over a long season. And here's the one that now it's a long ways off. We're not talking about we're talking about October 21st and 29th. Nobody even wants to think about October right now. We just want to enjoy June and July and August. But the last two games of the season are two of the three against Ottawa, where you could, if injuries are not a problem, you could be facing Jeremiah Masoli, where you could have your season standings, maybe a fight for a playoff spot up for grabs. Now, look, Jeremiah Masoli was not great last year when he was in, but I also think that, I refuse to poo-poo the idea that players who get sent away or told that the team doesn't want them, they have a chip on their shoulder. They desperately, even if they say they don't, they desperately want to beat the team that got rid of them.
Sure, why wouldn't he? He's a competitor.
Of course.
And the funny thing is, and I know you're not the only person saying it, that, Masoli wasn't very good last year. But you know what? He won. He won games. Like, he won despite maybe not playing to what we saw a couple of years before blowing out his knee. So even some of those ugly performances, the team still won games. And one thing I definitely know about that team for the last couple of years, they really believed in Masoli. They really, really liked the guy. And there's something to be said about that. So
yeah,
extend to the likes of Dane Evans, but they really did like Masoli last year. So. I don't know. I mean, Matthew Schultz is a good quarterback. As I said, he's gotten some experience with the Montreal Alouettes. I just don't know how good of a starter he will be if it's for a long-term injury.
I would simply not want the Hamilton Tiger Cats, my point was, to get down to the last two games of the year where those two games are hugely impactful on what's going to happen to you in the playoffs because...
You know they will, though.
Well, probably. Probably.
In this jumbled up East, it will.
The Ticats were 8-6 last year. It was a shortened season, so they played four games less than normal. But let's extrapolate where they were and say that makes them a 10-8 team, give or take. Are they a 10-8 team again this year in a weaker, in a stronger East? Probably. I would think they would be a 10-8 team, but if you're 9-9 or if you're 8-10, heaven forbid, I don't think they'll be that, but boy, now it's dicey. Now and you go 9-9, almost certainly you're not going to have a home game in the playoffs, and that's a big deal for Hamilton.
That's a huge advantage. We saw that last year, but the team also did show an ability to go on the road and win a huge playoff game when they did it in that comeback win over Toronto. But to your point there, Scott, I think 11-7 wins the East this year.
It could. We've got to run here. What's really going to be interesting, the Ticats start their season Saturday. They play against Saskatchewan. Their first four games are all against the West, and five of their first six are against the West. So we don't really get much of a sense of how they're going to stack up against the East until we start getting into a stretch in July, end of July, Montreal, Toronto, Toronto, Montreal, Toronto, Toronto, where all of a sudden you say, okay, now we're going to find out where this team is. Because if they went out in their first four games and went 2-2 or 1-3, would it be shocking? Saskatchewan, that's going to be a real tough game. Calgary, that's always a tough game. Winnipeg, that's a real tough game. Edmonton, you would think they win. Boy, it's going to be an interesting season. And I should say, because we do have to run, I should say, you can hear Bubba O'Neill nonstop talking about the Ticats now on the Ticats Audio Network, which the games are here on CHML. He is the pregame. He is halftime. He's postgame. He's intermissions on or interviews on the sideline. He brings water to the players. He fills up their coffee cups before the game. He does their laundry. He is so involved with this team now. You cannot get away from Bubba O'Neill or something.
Look, I'll be honest with you. I'm really looking forward to working with Andy Fantuz on those broadcasts. But you know what? My job is just to put the ball on the tee and let guys like him and Tasker and Courtney Stevens and let those guys run with the ball. I'm just there to hand off. That's it. I'm the
you're the David Watkins of the broadcast booth.
Yeah,
or Watford.
The David Watford, the ball
Watford of the broadcast.
Of the broadcast. So I won't be doing much talking.
Yeah, Bubba won't even say, and now we're going to throw it back to the studio. He's going to say, now we're going to hand it off back to the studio. Bubba O'Neill from CHCH, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode, and also be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.